Tuesday, April 7th on Connecticut Today, we follow the ever-changing coronavirus outbreak situation. Why are women, in many cases, better suited to deal with COVID-19 than men? We asked that in hour number one of a very prominent physician. He gave us some interesting research that went into his new book. And then in the second hour of the program, we talked to a professor from Quinnipiac University about how the gaming industry is seeing unprecedented increases in use over the past few weeks. Our first guest of the day, an award-winning scientist, physician, biotech inventor, and best-selling author of books like Survival of the Sickest. His new book is called The Better Half, on the genetic superiority of women. We welcome to Connecticut Today Dr. Sharon Moalem. Dr. Moalem, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you today?
Good, Paul. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, how often do you present that title to women, you know, and they go, well, yeah, of course, right? We knew this. Does that happen at all?
Yeah, it does happen often. I mean, the one unfortunate expectation while I was, doing research over the years for this book was I never imagined or even hoped for that there would be a pandemic to prove my theory about the female survival advantage. But as we're seeing now in every country around the world, men are not doing well. They're really floundering in the face of this virus. And it really comes down to this fact that men just don't have, the genetic choices that females do.
Okay, so let's start from a base level here, doctor, with the XY chromosome. A lot of us took, well, a lot of us that are not in the medical profession as you are, we remember from our basic, high school level genetics and biology, which I thoroughly enjoy and I still refer back to today. A person may say, well, okay, the chromosomes are different, but why do women seem to fare, at least in this case, Dr. Moalem, better than men do?
Well, I'll give you this is really a classic example that I get into in the Better App. So classically, women have they inherit two X chromosomes, one from their father, one from their mother, and men one chromosome from their mother. And so it seems that this coronavirus has a key that's able to unlock human cells. It's called a spike protein. And the lock that it unlocks in human cells is encoded on the X chromosome. So it means that I'm an XY genetic male. All of my cells are identical when it comes to the X chromosome. So all the locks are the same. So if I hope I don't encounter a coronavirus that has the right key to unlock all my cells. If that happens, I'm in trouble. As opposed to a genetic female who has two X chromosomes, that would mean that she'd have two populations of cells, two different locks. So a coronavirus would have to have a very good key that would be able to unlock two different locks, and the likelihood for that is not great. And that's actually what we're seeing happening right now around the world. We're seeing coronaviruses able to break into males' bodies with ease because they're all using the same lock, the one that's encoded in the single X chromosome they inherited from their mother.
Now, that's fascinating. This, of course, the novel coronavirus or a strain of coronaviruses, Dr. Moalem, that we've known about before, is that key or that spike you referred to, is that particular just to COVID-19, or have we seen this? Do we know whether other strains of the coronavirus can do that?
We have. Actually, when you go back to the we're in the rerun. This is COVID-19 is very similar to the virus that caused SARS back almost 20 years ago. And SARS and COVID-19 both enter cells through the same lock. SARS, which we experienced 20 years ago, didn't do it that well. And thankfully, that's why it didn't become a pandemic. But it seems that the COVID-19 has an unbelievable, almost like one of these keys that can open up, any lock that it practically can encounter. And that's one of the reasons we think that it can spread so far and wide. But when it comes to survival, having that extra chromosome that women have, because that chromosome, the extra X chromosome has genes on it for the immune system and for building a brain, women have this genetic resource that men just don't have.
So it's a sense, doctor, like having a storage unit, and when you lop that lock onto your storage unit, there's room for a second lock here, and it's that advantage that women have that you said that essentially, to make it to a level that folks may understand, it's a second padlock is what you're saying.
That's exactly what it is. I love that analogy of a second padlock. And when we look at the numbers, we're actually not really considering what's happening. So if you know, the numbers that have been reported now, it's about 60 to 70% of the mortality is in men all over the world in every country we've looked. But what we don't factor into those numbers is after the age of 70, when you look at the people who are alive, only 20% of those people are men. And since this is really affecting people older and mostly older individuals when it comes to mortality, there's not a lot of men at the far end of life. And so if 60 to 70% of people who are dying are men, you have to imagine that's of the 25% that currently exists. So this is really, unfortunately, just really wiping out a whole generation of men.
Did we see, Dr. Mualim, this same gender leaning in the information from SARS or not?
We did. When SARS first broke out in and around Hong Kong, that's what was noticed. And another related coronavirus is called MERS, M-E-R-S, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus. And that one also seems to predominantly affect men. And this isn't, like I said, you know, when I was doing my work for the book, The Better Half, I wasn't hoping that we would ever see this happen in front of us. But when it comes to surviving pandemics and famine, men usually always struggle. And so although men have more physical mass, muscular strength, and height, and the ability to throw farther, to lift more weight, when it comes to surviving the challenges of life, men unfortunately flounder.
And I know, Dr. Mualim, in your book, you do raise the point or the question of why a lot of medical research, or maybe more properly focused here, why more medical research isn't generally done on women to see if we can better understand this whole male-female dichotomy.
Yeah, and I mean, the point you bring up is fascinating, and the reason was we didn't want to do a disservice to women by excluding them. We excluded them because the assumption was women were the weaker sex, and so we needed to protect them, and we needed to send young males off into these clinical trials and you know, face the unknown of accepting an experimental drug. What we didn't know at the time is that actually women are biologically stronger. And by excluding them, when we developed most of the medications we have today, when we prescribe them to women, it's really a guess as to what the side effects are and what the effects are. And, you know, we even see that today when it comes to vaccinations. Women don't require as large of a dose of a vaccine as men do, because women's immune systems also are so aggressive and critical. And so when you give them the dose that you would give a male patient, they often get side effects because their immune system overreacts. And the reason is you need to give a very big dose of a vaccine to a male because their immune cells are really fundamentally lazy. You kick them off that immunological couch, they need a very big dose of a vaccine.
Yeah, that's in fact, that was the exact next thing I was going to ask you. And anecdotally, I have heard, Dr. Mualim, that, you know, I do have women friends of mine who have taken vaccines and asked me, you know, if we've taken the same thing. I said, well, I had a bit of a reaction to that, but not bad. And, you know, they tell me with the same thing that, you know, of the heightened sensitivity they have to it.
That's right. And for years, I mean, this is what I was taught just a few years ago going through medical school, to expect my female patients to be complaining after getting a vaccine because they're more vocal. They see their doctors often. But in reality, it's just because their immune system is taking the vaccine seriously, reacting appropriately. And when they would encounter that microbe in the future, they're prepared. Unfortunately, for many males anyways, the reason that they're not experiencing any side effects, their immune system essentially just slept through the vaccine, didn't get off that couch, and didn't respond to it appropriately. And the result is that when they experience or expose to the microbe in the future, they don't react and the vaccine doesn't even work.
A few more fascinating minutes with our first guest of the day, Dr. Sharon Mualim, MD, PhD. His latest book, The Better Half, on the genetic superiority of women, something that's been bounced about and bandied about for years and years. Dr. Mualim, what is, you may have answered this already, forgive me, but I'm looking at the notes here. What is the Red Riding Hood defense?
Well, what this is going back to what we're talking about with women's cells being very critical. Mm-hmm. And so many microbes like COVID-19 that try to get into the body often dress themselves up as human cells and try to sneak in. Just like the wolf wearing grandma's clothing. And so female cells are very good at picking out these wolves that are dressing up as grandma and killing them before they can wreak havoc in the body. And often male cells are just not really good at that, doing that. The damage, though, sometimes that happens, the downside of this female genetic immunological superiority is that often female immune cells can mistake a wolf in grandma's clothing for actual grandmas, for their own cells. And so female cells can often attack their own cells indiscriminately, you know, because they're just so aggressive. And so what we think is that we think this is actually behind why women suffer from autoimmunity to such high degree. Conditions like lupus, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, all these conditions are much more presented in women. To the case in lupus, actually, it's 9 women for every one man
wow.
diagnosed.
That's true. You never, now that you mention it, you don't really hear you meaning, you know, genetically in life, or generically, I should say, in life, you don't hear of a lot of men getting lupus. And I did off the top of my head, I know 5 or 6 women that have it. Interesting. One of your areas is evolutionary biology, Dr. Mo'Allaman. If you and I could transport or come back in 100 years, assuming they have not patented the 100-year pill before we leave, genetically, what will men and or women look like, you think, in maybe 100 years? Or is that too soon to see any major genetic changes or not?
Well, I think what we're going to be seeing is a lot of genetic editing under this new type of technology called CRISPR. And so this allows us to edit our genes. And currently it's illegal in most countries, although it was done not too long ago in China. And the result of which is we might actually see us adding certain features, adding genes from other animals, other insects. So, for example, the gene that allows fireflies to glow at night, you can add that to a human. And so I think what we're going to see is a lot of that type of editing and moving forward in the genetic field.
So is somebody going to really try and pull off Spider-Man? Is that what you're telling me here?
It sounds like, I think, you know, no matter what governments try to stop people from doing, the example recently was, which would happen in mainland China, was they edited human babies. And, I mean, they tried to do it in a positive way by editing and creating resistance against HIV. But once you take that step, then there's no real indication for you to not to edit for any other feature.
Yeah. Doctor, final question here. Where do you think we go with the coronavirus over the next month, 2 months, 3 months? What are you hearing in your medical field amongst yourselves? And what's your best guess when the tail off begins and if we're going to get this rebound that everyone is talking about?
You know, a lot of it depends on how well we do with staying at home and really blocking the chain of transmission. If we're able, you know, we've heard a lot about flattening the curve. If we do that and stop the rate of transmission, we're going to be with coronavirus and the infection for a bit longer. But at least we delay the amount of cases that have to go and present themselves to the hospital. And the idea is we really don't want to overwhelm our medical resources, because that's when the degree of the number of fatality really increases. So I think what we're looking at least is a very similar situation for the next few months. But I'm hopeful, as I always am, because humanity has had to face much worse pathogens throughout our history. And one way or another, we've always managed to survive.
He's an award-winning physician, scientist, biotech inventor, and best-selling author. His previous books included the New York Times bestseller, Survival of the Sickest, The DNA Restart, and Inheritance. By the way, that was an Amazon Best Science Book of the Year. You can go out and grab now at Amazon, wherever you get your books, The Better Half on the Genetic Superiority of Women. Dr. Sharon Mo'Allam, Doctor, thank you. Good luck in the future, and hopefully we can chat. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, a lot of folks are staying home, obviously. Social distancing, that goes to a lot of students as well, from grammar school all the way on up through college and grad school. A lot of folks, not just students, adults, passing the time the upcoming days, weeks, and months. Gaming, the gaming industry now, video games that everybody laughed at 15, 20, 25 years ago. Mainline entertainment now, huge titles. Some of them being adapted for movies, too. But what's the state of the gaming industry, gaming education? You can go to college and get a background in this, as you can, at Quinnipiac University. Joining us right now from the queue, Professor Gregory Garvey. He's professor of game design and development. He directs game design and development at the school as well. Professor Paul here. How are you today, sir?
I'm very good, thank you.
Well, you know, Professor, gaming was big. Obviously, it was big way pre-COVID-19 coronavirus. But I guess, well, you tell me, is the industry, is the gaming world, is it a little more in focus now, getting a little shot in the arm here, at least from people staying home and having to pass the hours, the weeks, the days in social distancing?
Well, the numbers are coming in with multiple sources reporting that, for example, Verizon gaming usage is up 75%. Iron Source, which reports on the industry for a monetization app, that average daily users in the U.S. is overall up 13%. Big spike in Korea and another spike in Italy and in China, of course, being the center of the original outbreak in Wuhan. There was a 65% jump, which kind of overlapped with the Lunar New Year celebrations, which occurred at the very end of January. So worldwide, the games, you know, the access is exploding. Steam, a major platform for indie game developers and so-called independent games, at the end of March reported 22 million unique accesses. So, and this is, you know, against a backdrop of for over 10 years now, the total revenues in games worldwide exceeded total box office. And today, the reality is that it is online video gaming, or in every form, is the biggest entertainment revenue generator that exceeds all the other entertainment forms rolled into one.
That's so, that's an amazing figure. And of course, mm-hmm. Professor, it's so easy, I guess, now to track this stuff. It's not like when you and I, you know, were kids and we were, you know, jamming Atari cartridges into a machine or a Nintendo cartridge into a handheld thing. So these systems, the, you know, the PlayStation, Xbox, it's much like subscription television, cable or direct TV, where they know what people are doing and what games are popular. And it's, you know, the data must be fascinating to pour into here.
Well, one of the strategies has been so-called free-to-play. And so many games have shifted to this, where then you make in-game purchases. One of the biggest spaces, which has radically expanded in the last 5-6 years, is so-called casual gaming, games like, you know, Candy Crush Saga, you know, and one of the biggest pushes, and this is really in the mobile space, is with Pokemon Go.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, was a remarkable success by Niantic, which has made other games, which are not quite as popular, but that literally put the games in the hands of both, you know, hardcore players, but also people who are new to the gaming experience. So Angry Birds is another example.
Oh, yeah.
So it's no longer, you know, there is the myth of the isolated male teenager playing alone in his room. Today, because almost so many game experiences can be accompanied by online chats, there's various networking features, whether it's on consoles, PlayStation, or the Nintendo Switch. Gaming is now an intensely social experience. And one of the best examples of this is in the realm of esports, which has exploded in recent years. And even going back like 3 or 4 years, for the finals of one tournament, which had like an $18 million purse,
yeah,
the total of online viewers of the finals exceeded the final episode of Breaking Bad.
Wow.
So the numbers are really quite astounding.
Another segment here, fascinating stuff. Professor Gregory Garvey at Quinnipiac University, professor of game design and development, the gaming industry, watching what people are doing during the COVID-19 lockdown in many areas, social distancing. Professor, do we have any clue? Does the industry have any clue? Have you seen any info regarding the types of games that are being played here during this lockdown? Is it an across-the-board rise, or are there any things that the data shows vis-a-vis the type of game versus what we're going through right now?
Well, I think it varies according to different demographic groups. Probably among tweens, and some listeners, hopefully won't be offended, Fortnite is still extremely popular. For a while, it was the most popular game produced by Epic in the world, and it's a battle royale where 100 people compete to be the last player standing, and they can work in teams. And so this is an example of a game which really requires social interaction, where you form a team, you jump from these buses that fly overhead, land on an island, and then you work together to be the last team standing, and so forth. So there's many other games. A mainstay, which probably today remains one of the most popular games ever, is Minecraft, which is a wonderful, it's a truly educational environment where it's about mining, where you discover resources and building. And there are people not only build islands and fortresses and palaces, but then they build mini games. And it requires social interaction, online chats. It's been, some of the oldest players are probably in their late 40s now, and the youngest players are probably 8, 9, 10 years old. Animal Crossing is another game that's pretty huge, and that is, you arrive on a semi-private island, mm-hmm. and you see these anthropomorphic animals everywhere. And, again, this is another game that promotes social engagement.
So these games really do – it's not like the early games here where there was no communication here and you just tried to rack up points and that's it. So you think, and other experts, Professor, that during this time where folks are forced to stay inside and people can't hang out the way they used to, they're still doing it just in a different way.
Yeah, and I think that so many of the games, there's a game called Sea of Thieves, and four friends can jump on a pirate galleon and set sail looking for treasure and adventure. And so many of the really popular games facilitate and provide multiplayer modes and online chats. So, yes, these are promoting social engagement in a way that was not true although it should be noted that often young kids, I watch it with my own son when he was growing up, even though they would play a console game, it would be three or four friends sitting around playing. So social interaction is kind of baked into the experience.
Yeah.
And when you think of even with Pokemon Go, really there's a generation that grew up with the deck building game of Pokemon. And so there's a wonderful transition that occurred. And Pokemon, you know, it's not only deck building, but you traded the cards and you would do battle. What's really ironic at this time is the World Health Organization has announced that it encourages people to stay home and play video games. And the U.S. ambassador to WHO posted a tweet calling for people to, follow this hashtag, play a part together, which was put together by the World Health Organization and major industry players. So this campaign, which is trending on Twitter and on itch.io and Discord, which are major discussion channels, and itch.io also is a great place to find games to download to play. And it's really ironic. The World Health Organization is promoting this hashtag, and because it was just a few years ago that they included in what is called gaming disorder, and pointing to that, you know, games can be addictive and obsessive and can be a problem when it leads to social isolation and, not excluding normal activities.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Boy, it changes on a dime, doesn't it? Well, Professor, we'll have to look at what happens after there's some sense of normalcy put back here and see if this really was a watershed moment of many for the gaming industry. He's a professor of game design and development. A lot of students going into that now. They can be the next, Marty Scorsese or whomever of game design. Professor Gregory Garvey at Quinnipiac University. Professor, thank you. It's been fascinating. We appreciate the time. Thanks.
And thank you for having me.